The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Misha Galperin, the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The world, and especially the Arab and Middle Eastern world, has been transfixed by events in Cairo the last 10 days or so. President Hosni Mubarak, head of Egypt for the past 30 years, is discovering that his long reign is nearly over, and in a virtually unthinkable way, by popular uprising. Following the sudden and unexpected collapse of another Arab dictatorship in Tunisia last month, huge street protests instantly materialized all over Egypt in late January and into February, especially in the crowded streets of Cairo. Although Mubarak had a huge police force and many, many secret police keeping the Egyptian people in line. Almost overnight, he lost control. How could this happen in a large nation of 80 million people that is the second largest recipient of American foreign aid? $1.3 billion in direct military aid, $250 million in financial aid last year. And Egypt has been a bastion of political stability since the assassination of Anwar Sadat in 1980, which catapulted Mubarak to the throne, or presidency. Actually, it's quite simple. Over 8 years ago, on Too Jewish, Rabbi Kohan talked about Egypt. And in December of 2002, I said, having traveled in Egypt several times, I can tell you that the Egyptian people are generally very open and warm, and the country is a complete basket case. In Cairo, many people literally live in tombs erected by their cultural ancestors, while the tiny elite drive gold-plated Mercedes. No doubt, it is the Israelis' fault that so many Egyptians' lives are miserably poor, of course, rather than their permanent president-cum-dictator, Hosni Mubarak. That was 8 years ago, and it certainly hasn't gotten any better. I have visited Egypt on four occasions, three times as a tourist, once on a rabbinic mission trip. I first went to Egypt in the fall of 1991. I found it to be a country with an extraordinary disparity between a tiny, wealthy, powerful elite and a vast population of extremely poor, ordinary citizens. And that has been increasingly true on every subsequent visit. The contrasts are startling and continual. As you walk along the street in Cairo, you see public buses literally crammed with people. When they passed, you could see faces pressed flush against the windows from the bottom to the top. It looked like containers for human sardines. It was grotesque. The main tourist streets in Cairo are elegant boulevards, or at least they were when I was there, with westernized hotels and shops. But when I went running with a friend just two blocks off the main drag, all pavement disappeared. Tiny hovels crowded along mosquito-filled canals. Animals, dogs, goats, chickens, cats, and humans filled the tiny refuse-heaped mud paths, and deep third-world poverty was rampant. The main streets had policemen or military guys lounging on every corner, but the side streets were a completely different story. Inevitably, on the back streets, as we ran by in our American shorts and t-shirts and tennis shoes, kids and sometimes adults would shout, chase us, and throw stones or refuse towards us. Although Egypt has an amazing wealth of antiquities and fabulous tourist sites, it also has a huge population of well-educated yet still fantastically poor citizens. This is not a good recipe. Certain statistics we were quoted on my various trips have stuck with me. 60 to 70% of the population of Egypt is infected with the stomach parasite Giardia, a direct consequence of terrible sanitation, combined with the fact that everyone gets water from the Nile River. And since the construction of the Aswan Dam by the Soviet Union in the 1960s, it requires major filtration and treatment to clean out the various microscopic organisms infecting it. Only the rich can afford to do that, so the rest of the population just, you know, suffers. Several incidents during my various Egyptian travels really struck me. We once had to go to a hospital in Cairo. It was a brand new building, and we were among the very few patients there that day. It ended up taking several hours, but not because of a lack of personnel. In fact, there were multiple very kind nurses attending us throughout the experience. Eventually, we saw at least 4 different doctors, all of whom were patient and kind, and they consulted together. A hand was hurt, so several kinds of x-rays and other images were made. Eventually, the injury was carefully bandaged, treated with medication. We were given a prescription that the pharmacy filled immediately. I was worried about what we would be charged for all of this first-rate medical attention. The injury ultimately proved to be painful but minor, and then I was astonished when I got the bill at the end for all the fine medical treatment. $23 in American cash. I paid it happily, but wondered how such a system could possibly work economically. On another trip with a group of Reform rabbis in Egypt to support the then-important Oslo peace process, we had a formal meeting at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry with Amr Moussa, foreign minister, later head of the Arab League. We were driven into a magnificent compound surrounded by large gold Mercedes, the car of choice of Egypt's public servants, apparently, and escorted into a skyscraper office building. Every Egyptian seemed to be wearing an Armani suit. There were subtle flashes of Rolex gold watches on each wrist. Refreshments were served, opulent ones. Then Moussa himself came in. He was an elegant man who spoke to us of the need for Israel to reform its treatment of Palestinians, especially in Gaza. He did not much care for questions, especially ones about Egypt's treatment of Palestinians when it controlled the Gaza Strip, but what stayed with me was the stunning contrast between the huge mass of the Egyptian people, with their per capita income of perhaps $1,000 a year, and the Egyptian governmental leaders with their $5,000 wristwatches. One night, unable to sleep, another rabbi and I, Bob Davis, had a long conversation with a Cairo Hilton Hotel's night manager, a charming young man who spoke English fluently and had a college degree. He was engaged to a woman he wished to marry, but in order to do so, he had to come up with a kind of bride price of something like $40,000 in cash to give her family. That is apparently the custom there. He spoke about his dreams for the future, the fact that he had this plum job in an American-owned hotel, his desire to have children. My friend asked him how much money he made. We expected naively that he must be making a good salary in such a responsible position, and that the 40 grand he needed to get married would take a few years to save. Then he told us his salary was $1,800 a year. I'm not quite sure how long it takes to save $40,000 on an annual salary of $1,800, but it's gotta be a really long time. To be honest, none of the economic realities of Egypt made sense to us. And apparently, they no longer make sense to the Egyptian people either. We Jews have had an incredibly long, challenging experience with Egypt for over 3,000 years. Of course, famously, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt until God and Moses, an Egyptian prince with an Egyptian name, freed us and brought us out of that rich land. In biblical times, Egypt was an enemy at many times and an ally of Israel and Judah at other times. And from the destruction of the first temple by Babylonians in 586 BCE, an Egyptian diaspora Jewish community has existed. Jews have lived in Egypt and often thrived in Egypt ever since. Great Jewish communities once existed in Alexandria and Cairo, and the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Cairo is still a magnificent and moving building. I led services there once. The Cairo Geniza archives, discovered in the 19th century, provided a huge treasure trove of documents that testify to a large, vibrant, rich, dynamic Jewish community throughout the Middle Ages. Perhaps the greatest Jewish scholar, legalist, philosopher, thinker of all time, Moses Maimonides, did a lot of his great work in the Cairo of his day, called Fustat, in the 12th century. The Egyptian Jewish community today is tiny, but it has long included many Israelis engaged in doing business there. After four failed wars against Israel, Egypt made peace in the late 70s, and after Anwar Sadat's assassination by Islamists for the treachery of making that peace, Hosni Mubarak took over, and he has kept things with Israel peaceful. It's called a cold peace, which it is. Major boulevards in Cairo are named after the date of the Egyptian invasion of Israel during the Yom Kippur War, and Cairo newspapers regularly spout viciously anti-Semitic rhetoric, but nonetheless, it has been a durable and very, very important peace for Israel. Egypt is a kind of standing contradiction. In ancient times, it was the wealthiest country in the world, producing food like clockwork, its water supply coming from the annual flooding of the Nile, which also left a huge supply of topsoil each year derived from the African highlands that are the source of the Nile. In those days, Egyptians simply had to wait out the floodwaters each year on the high ground, return home, and plant crops in freshly watered and newly fertile fields. It was a recipe for great wealth then, as seen by the opulent burial tombs of the pharaohs. King Tut was an incredibly minor figure, ruled for a couple of years, yet he was buried with more wealth than all the kings of the world probably possessed in aggregate at the time. Egypt in the ancient world had everything. Centuries later, in Islamic times, the new Arab people who inhabited Egypt built an elaborate civilization there, and Egypt still sees itself as being at the heart of the Arab and Muslim world. But for many years, this country has just not worked. It has been kept under control by an inordinate number of security personnel under the direct control of Mubarak. There has indeed been freedom of the press, if by that you mean freedom to criticize anything, especially Israel, but not, never, Mubarak or his government. And there's been a kind of democracy, if by democracy you mean a powerless elected legislature and a president who gets reelected without opposition for, 30 years. So now, after three decades of Mubarak's heavy-handed, even brutal rule, the Egyptians have partly figured it out. Of course, they haven't quite gotten it all correctly. A big part of their uprising against Mubarak's corrupt and endless regime is that they think he is too pro-Israel. And the effigies of Mubarak that protesters hung in Tahrir Square had blue Magen David, Stars of David, scrawled on them to demonstrate Egypt's continuing hostility to Israel in spite of those 30 years of peace. So, what's next? Well, of course, no one really knows, but I have two guesses. First, either the Egyptian military will take over, keep Mubarak in power for a while, and then designate a secular successor. Or some democratic process will really emerge, and eventually that democratic process will be taken control of by the Egyptian Brotherhood and other Islamist allies. That currently appears the most likely scenario to me, which presents Israel and America with the unenviable prospect of a modern American-built and trained military in Egypt in the control of Muslim fundamentalists. I hope and pray that isn't how it will go, and so does Israel, and so too should America. To play us in this morning on the theme of Mitzrayim, Egypt, here's the Egyptian Jewish singer Leila Murad, named the official singer of the Egyptian revolution of the 1950s against King Farouk, the one that put Nasser in power. A Jewish singer, believe it or not. It's her song, Tusmika.
وارحم عيني اسأل علي وارحم عيني من دمع ريحة ودمع كيا اسأل علي حبيبي انت الوحيد ومهما تقسى حبي يزيد حبيبي انت الوحيد ومهما تقسى حبي يزيد يا ليا اللي ودي يا لي غيرك ولا لي احد ولا افتكر لك غير كل ودي وعشان بحبك يصعب علي واقول غرامك ما كانش لي وعشان بحبك يصعب علي واقول غرامك ما كانش لي كان غرامك كله قاسية اسأل علي اسأل علي وارحم عيني اسأل علي وارحم عيني من دمع ريحة ودمع كي اسأل علي.
That was the Egyptian Jewish singer Leila Mourad. For a couple of decades, the most popular singer in Egypt and a rival of Umm Kulthum at a time when Egypt and Israel were bitter enemies. We hope that Egypt returns from violence to singing sometime soon and that the peace that has prevailed for 30 years with Israel will remain in place. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Misha Galperin, the new head of the Jewish Agency, an important and poorly understood organization in Jewish life. Find out what the Jewish Agency does today when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. When we were kids, my mom used to tell Vinny and me, take time and smell the meatballs. Back then, Vinny and I always took this literally. After all, the smell of meatballs was often present in our home. But as time has gone by, we've learned there's more to Mom's reminder. Now we know that when you stop and smell the meatballs, you're really taking time to do stuff with attention, love, and care. In restaurant terms, it means we need to select the right ingredients for our pizzas, sandwiches, and salads. We need to simmer our sauces for just the right amount of time. We need to hand assemble our calzones and lovingly season and bake our garlic cheese toast. Yes, at Mama's, to stop and smell the meatballs means lots of things, including taking time to sometimes actually stop and smell the meatballs. Because trust me, they do smell good. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Misha Galperin. He's the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for International Development. His position, which was created, I think, really especially for him, is directing the Jewish Agency for Israel's external affairs, financial resource development and marketing and communications worldwide and all of its operations in North America. He coordinates the agency's relationships with North American Jewish federations, as well as a wide variety of Jewish organizations, both in America, Israel, and all around the world. Can you explain a little bit for our listeners what the Jewish Agency really is today?
The Jewish Agency is the global Jewish table. It is the one organization which is the formal link between the Jewish communities of the diaspora and the Jewish state and the Israel society. This is the way it was put together in 1948, and then after the state was created, after the Jewish Agency transformed from being the government of Israel in waiting, when its chairman, David Ben-Gurion, became the first prime minister, of Israel, and then went on to become the instrument of the Jewish people in bringing in the exiles, the immigrants to Israel, 3 million of them, building up the Jewish state physically by building over 900 villages, towns, institutions, etc. Today, the Jewish Agency is moving on to its next phase, focusing on inspiring young Jews world over to connect with their people, with their heritage, and with their land, and to empower them to create a thriving Jewish future and a strong Israel.
You know, most of us who have grown up in the latter part of the 20th century remember the Jewish Agency being instrumental in sometimes saving Jewish communities, helping them come to Israel as part of a consortium of various other organizations working in that field. What's the most interesting new program that the Jewish Agency is involved with in terms of connecting the disaffected young Jews or unconnected young Jews to their Jewish heritage?
I think that one of the most interesting programs that we now run is something called Masa, Israel Journey. Masa is an Israel experience program. In fact, it's more than one program. It's about 170 different programs where young men and women between the ages of 18 and 30 come to Israel for between 5 months and a year and are enrolled in everything from a semester abroad at Hebrew University or Bar-Ilan to volunteering for the army, to doing an internship at the Begin Center for government, to doing a medical residency at a hospital, et cetera, et cetera. Many of these programs are actually tailored for the young people. All of these programs also have a component that has to do with learning about the community, about volunteerism, about Jewish history and the Jewish state. The recent study by Steve Cohen, which looked at about 13,000 unaffiliated or low-affiliated participants in various programs, has some amazing statistics about how a long-term trip to Israel that follows a short-term experience like birthright
or to the Taglit programs, right?
Right, makes all the difference in the world, in everything from dramatically decreasing intermarriage rates to actually preparing people to become leaders in the Jewish community. It's a program where next year we expect to bring in 11,000 young men and women to Israel, and the other wonderful thing about it is it's a partnership with the government, where for every dollar the Jewish Agency puts in from the money that we receive from federations and our other partners is matched on a dollar-to-dollar basis by the government of Israel.
We will talk much more with Misha Galperin, the President and CEO of the Jewish Agency for International Development, when we come back on Too Jewish a little later this morning.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade, has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Jewish studies curriculum, with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs. THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio gives its highly qualified faculty the ability to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in a modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. THA Tucson Hebrew Academy is enrolling now. Give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll or to schedule a tour, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from the website or at the Apple iTunes Store as subscribable podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, our expert on Israeli issues. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Kiryat Malachi, a predominantly Ethiopian development town that our own Tucson City and Israel Center partnered with, just won a major award in Israel that I had never heard of until they announced it. So maybe you can tell us what it is and why it matters.
The Israeli Minister of Education, Gideon Sar, awarded Kiryat Malachi the Israel Education Prize for this year. The Israel Education Prize is a nationwide prize. It's a contest from all elementary schools and high schools and education systems between all towns and cities in Israel. And there is a committee that the minister creates. And the committee goes from school to school, from city to city, to look where they see the most significant change and improvement in education. Kiryat Malachi was chosen, and I can give you some numbers to explain why. About 6 years ago, Kiryat Malachi had 37% of its high school graduate that got matriculation examinations passed. Okay, that passed their test.
The Bagrut, you mean?
The Bagrut.
Right.
Last year, they had over 70% graduation that succeed in the exams. Now, I want to point out one of the main aspects that helped Kiryat Malachi to achieve this amazing success is the TIPS partnership. The TIPS partnership is a partnership of Tucson, Seattle, and Phoenix together with Kiryat Malachi and Chof Ashkelon. It is based on committees in all cities, including our own here in Tucson. Here in Tucson, it is being led by the Weintraub family and chaired by Sue Sheridan. And TIPS create projects, mainly in education programs for teenagers in Kiryat Malachi, projects like Art City that helps teenagers learn dance and singing and get more values out of learning those aspects. And also a program like Tafnit that takes the 25% of students in class that gets to lower grades and help them improve their grades and reach out to narrow the gap. And those two programs significantly helped Kiryat Malachi to achieve this prize, and not only achieving the prize, but really improving significantly the education system in Kiryat Malachi.
Well, it's a great accomplishment, and the educational work being done with Ethiopians in development towns and all throughout Israel is really the core of what will happen in the future. If people are well-educated, then they fit in society better, they succeed more, they rise in every aspect of society. So mazel tov to Kiryat Malachi.
Mazel tov, thank you.
We'll talk next week, Guy. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife, although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we were talking about this incident you had in Santiago de Chile, in the capital of Chile, the big, giant city of Chile, where you ended up attending by accident or being present when there was a big Jewish reception on December 25th for a wedding. And it raised the whole question of a Shabbos goy. So I think I want to try to clarify that that's about what the incident was, right?
Right. I mean, actually, I didn't attend. I just saw people gathering, putting on kippot, very dressed up.
You crashed the wedding, is what you're saying here. Let's be honest.
No, but I was with a guy from Scottsdale who wanted to crash. We just weren't dressed for it.
Such a pity. The question is, and the term sounds derisive, but it's really not. A Shabbos goy, or essentially a non-Jew who does certain work for Jews on the Sabbath that Jews are precluded from doing by Jewish law, is an institution that goes back to the days of the Talmud and quite likely before then. Because in the Torah itself, it specifies 39 categories of work. And those are the major categories, as of course being the Jewish law, many subcategories of things you're not supposed to do on the Sabbath. A couple of which are kind of essential for Oneg Shabbat, enjoying the Sabbath. So a Jew is not permitted to light a fire in any manner on the Sabbath, specifically prohibited. The Talmud stretched that and said, you know, any kind of work that might be construed as creating a fire. And so when,
or using a pepper grinder.
Well, there's many other things. I mean, you can't grind, you can't chop, you can't cut. You can't make animals work on the Sabbath. In the Roman world, they thought this was absurd.
Juice a lemon.
Yeah, you can't write three letters. You can write two by accident and then stop yourself. It's not a crime. So all of this is designed to protect the Sabbath. Susiag la Torah, build a fence around the Torah, protect the institution of the Sabbath. By and large, it has been observed in one way or another by Orthodox Jews pretty scrupulously, and by conservative Jews, and to a degree by Reform and other Jews as well, for a very long time. As Ahad Ha'am said, more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath has kept us Jews. So there's lots of great quotes about it. Now, having said all of that, what happens when you have certain essential things that you need to get done on the Sabbath? And those include turning on lights, which once electric lights came along, there was a big debate. Was it the same as lighting a match, which is lighting a fire? The answer was, yeah, kind of, because there was a filament in there. In fact, Shabbat candles came about so that you would have light burning when it fell dark and you'd still be able to enjoy the evening. It was kind of the rabbis getting around the law of the Torah to allow you to enjoy at least Friday night. So lots of people are asked to be Shabbos goys throughout history, whether it was General Powell when he was a kid growing up in the Bronx, or Elvis Presley.
Wait,
or
so if it's Yivanu Lahadlik at near Shabbat, that's like BS, that's made up?
That's correct. It's commanded not by God. Well, it is interesting because a law, see, you're learning something on Too Jewish. A law commanded in the Torah can also be a law that the rabbis delineate from the Torah. It's not at the same level as a Torah law, but it's still halacha, still Jewish law. So it's halacha midrabanan, not halacha midiraita, a law from the rabbis. Shabbat candles is a law from the rabbis. And in fact, the more stringent Jews thought the lighting of Shabbat candles was not only wimpy, but a violation of the law. So it was really the rabbis being lenient so you could enjoy the Sabbath. So Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbat is Lahadlik Ner Shel Rabbanan. You know, it's a,
right.
It's a law.
So
of the
you
rabbis.
Know what? It looks like we're going to have to discuss the institution of Shabbos Goy next
even
week.
More.
Put it off for another week.
But just like all around the world, there have been Shabbos Goys for a long time. And for many, it became sort of a compliment and an important job. And we'll talk a little bit more about it next week.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. 84-year-old Morris gets hit by a car and lies bleeding on the sidewalk. A policeman arrives, glancing at the victim, immediately calls for a priest and an ambulance. The priest arrives first. Bending over Morris, he asks, "Do you believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost?" Morris lifts his head, opens his eyes wide, and turns to the crowd. "I'm lying here dying, and this schmuck is asking me riddles?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Tetzaveh in the book of Exodus, a ritually oriented parsha which gives the commandment to create a ner tamid, an eternal light, for the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was the first sanctuary of the people of Israel, although, technically speaking, the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was a very elaborate portable tent. It was also the place where God's presence in the form of the Shekhinah resided. In a sense, that's where God lived. Or more accurately, since God is everywhere, it was where God was most available. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week, we're told that there should be a continual fire, a ner tamid, a constant light shining on the altar, sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not God. We must build the altar and the fire and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. You know, if you've ever kept a fire burning around the clock, say at a camp out or bonfire for heat on a cold winter's night in some frigid clime, you know just how much fuel you need to do it. You're always either stoking it or bringing in more wood to burn. If neglected for any length of time, that fire will burn out. So the Ner Tamid was not just a symbol, but a process, requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our spiritual life is like that ancient Ner Tamid. If we wish God's presence to illuminate our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, we too must feed our own Ner Tamid, must gently and regularly add spiritual fuel to the flame. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, saying blessings, personal and communal rituals, time for breathing and allowing God into our lives. All of these help feed the fire, and they must be done with regularity, or our own internal, eternal lights will go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. While today we simply pay electric bills to keep it alive, even that requires a bit of our active participation. But the symbolic purpose is greater still. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us that God is with us always. But we must take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll continue our discussion with Misha Galperin, head of the Jewish Agency, on what the most important projects are today for the Jewish people. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Yes.
As the unrest in Egypt exploded, Jordan, Yemen, and Lebanon experienced smaller but similar demonstrations. In a proactive move, Jordanian King Abdullah dismissed his own prime minister and appointed another, and the entire secularist Arab world shivered with concern that its corrupt house of cards could come toppling down at any moment. So far, there is no indication that the Tunisian and Egyptian uprisings will go viral throughout the dictatorships and monarchies of the Dar Maghreb, but it does remain a reasonable possibility. In an embarrassment, the appointment of Israel's new military chief of staff has been canceled because of a scandal over personal real estate. Major General Yoav Gallant had been set to succeed Lieutenant General Gabi Ashkenazi as the head of the IDF later this month. Gallant, however, allegedly took over several acres of public land near his home on a moshav in northern Israel. The cancellation of the job came after Israeli Attorney General Yehuda Weinstein said the legal difficulties made it difficult for him to support the appointment. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak decided then not to go ahead with the appointment. The Israeli Defense Forces Deputy Chief of Staff, Major General Yair Naveh, was named an interim Chief of Staff while a new candidate is vetted. Gallant's appointment was approved in September after Ashkenazi was not asked to extend his 4-year term by an additional year, as is customary. And David Frye, the rubber-faced comedian who made political impersonations, particularly of Richard Nixon, the cornerstone of his career, died in late January at the age of 77 in Las Vegas. David Frye began his career in New York City clubs, but hit on political impressions as his path to stardom when a talent scout saw him doing an impression of Robert F. Kennedy in 1965. That led to a TV appearance and the addition of numerous political and media figures of the day into Frye's act, including then-President Lyndon Johnson and Vice President Hubert Humphrey, among others. Frye, however, hit his stride with Nixon, whose exaggerated mannerisms and publicly expressed anxiety were perfect fodder for the comedian. Shoulders hunched, his deep-set eyes glowering, Mr. Frye captured the insecure, neurotic Nixon to perfection, the New York Times wrote. Frye's appropriation of Nixon's infamous line, "I am the president," said the review, seemed to get at the essence of a powerful politician in desperate need of validation. David Frye told an interviewer once that he captured Nixon not by copying his real actions, but by feeling his attitude, which is that he cannot believe he really is president. His first album, featuring his Nixon impersonation, "I Am the President," reached number 19 on the Billboard charts way back 40 years ago in 1970. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. Misha Galperin. He's the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for International Development. He directs the Jewish Agency's work for Israel's external affairs and does financial resource development and marketing and communications worldwide, which is quite a title. He was in the top 5 in the Forward 50 list of the most influential Jewish leaders in North America last year. How did that feel, and how did your family feel about that?
Oh, it was a bit of a shock, to find myself between the new majority leader of the Congress, Eric Cantor, and my compatriot, Sergey Brin, the
founder of Google, right? Another immigrant from the former Soviet Union.
Another immigrant from the former Soviet Union. Didn't quite think of myself as being in those categories, and still don't. I think my mother was very happy.
Of course.
Even reconciled herself to the fact that my doctorate is not, she would say, a real doctorate.
It's clinical psychology. It's not a medical doctorate. It doesn't really count.
Right. So, I think it was very gratifying, because the reason that the paper said that they picked me was because of this agenda that the Jewish Agency is now pursuing with my involvement, but more importantly with Natan Sharansky's leadership. This idea of being the instrument that helps Jewish people reconnect to being Jewish people and reconnect to Israel, because I think that's one of the greatest challenges that we as the Jewish people and Jewish communities face today, the fact that for so many young Jews, the idea that Jewish people are an extended family with a mission, which is how I've defined it in the past, is not such a clear idea, and they don't necessarily feel themselves to be part of this extended family.
No, I think that's
and if
really
they don't
true.
Feel themselves to be a part of that extended family, then Israel is not necessarily, the center and the homeland in the spiritual, let alone physical sense.
You know, one of the things that's been difficult, I grew up in the Jewish world. My father worked for synagogues. I've been associated with synagogues and Jewish organizations my whole life. I still have trouble figuring out which international or national Jewish organization does what. And I wonder if that's a little bit of the difficulty that younger people have, you know, between the various federations, the JDC, Joint Distribution Committee, the Jewish Agency, Karen Hayesod, various other, and many, many other Jewish organizations.
I'd be the last one to suggest that the Jewish communal world is, understandable and coherent and easily explainable. The alphabet soup that we have there is extraordinary. And I actually just wrote a piece, an opinion piece, was published the last couple of days, that talks about what I believe is a need for all of us who are interested in focusing on strengthening Jewish identity and Jewish connections to come together and pull together, because we actually have a pretty good consensus as to what needs to be done. Well, having said all of that, I think that for many years, people in the Jewish community had no idea what all of that alphabet soup is about. I don't think that the estrangement and the sort of weakening of the connections with organizations and with other Jews is about the alphabet soup. I think it's about the change in the sense of the values and the importance of and the meaning of being Jewish in the environment where it's become a choice. The choice is something that you would make if you feel compelled for some positive reason, in the absence of anti-Semitism, in the absence of threat, in the environment where a lot of people, began to believe that Israel is a fact of life and does not, there are no existential dangers to it. In that environment, unless people connect in some sort of positive, meaningful way, I think it's very hard to expect that they would be affiliating with organizations, supporting the community, etc., things that they used to do because it was just part of their understanding of what being Jewish is about.
So what is the consensus, do you think, among all of the many organizations about what needs to be done to remedy this problem or to address this environment of choice?
I think the basic consensus that exists is that immersive, positive Jewish experiences, such as day schools that are well run and that have great Jewish education as well as great secular education, that camps with, again, great programming and great Jewish content, that Israel trips short-term and intermediate-term and long-term, youth groups, the kinds of things where the young people are actually experiencing the joy and the meaningfulness and the pleasure and excitement of being a part of a living, breathing Jewish community. Those are the things that that work, and those are the things that we need to do a lot more of. They're additive. They work with each other. I think that's the consensus that now pretty much exists out there.
It seems to me that that's a secularist consensus that opposes the essential institution that has kept Judaism vibrant for 2,000 years, which is synagogue and synagogue communities. Is that an incorrect assessment?
I think the question is what kind of a synagogue experience. I think that a synagogue experience, which actually is an experience of a community, you know, would work just as well. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that we don't necessarily see that many situations where the kind of experience people have in the shul is that kind of a joyful, supportive, engaging, exciting, wonderful experience. There are certainly exceptions, and we know that it can happen. But absence the kind of obligation that exists. Look, I mean, you know, having been related to in parts of certain congregations in the modern Orthodox world, you know, there's very little that anyone can say about. I mean, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be in a community. It's wonderful when you know that anything happens to you, you know, people will be there for you and you'll be taken care of and your family will be supported. And it's wonderful to feel that that's what you are expected to do under the circumstances. You know, and there are congregations when that sort of thing happens. But I don't think that's the experience of most Jews in the United States at this point.
The question that came to me, looking at your book, it's a couple years old now, that you wrote with Dr. Erica Brown, The Case for Jewish Peoplehood, Can We Be One? What do you think we can be one?
I think we must. I think that we need to figure out how to focus not on the things that divide us, which is what we've been spending so much time and energy on, but on the things that we have in common. I think that given, you know, how dispersed we are physically, given, you know, how many choices exist for forming one's identity and its different components, I think that we absolutely can be, but we have to be competitive. We have to be able to compete with the world that, you know, is pulling us apart. And I think in order to do that, we need to focus on the things that we do have in common and that unite us.
Absolutely. One more question. Does being a clinical psychologist help you a great deal in working with Jewish organizations and individuals in your work?
Let me quote to you my training analyst who, when I first took a job as an executive of the Jewish community, he asked me just how many board members I have, and I told him 60. And he said, well, I always knew you were going to have a bigger practice than I.
I want to thank Dr. Misha Galperin for a fascinating interview on Too Jewish, a great visit here. We will like to call on you again sometime. Thank you, and continued success with this interesting and challenging work.
Pleasure. Kol tov.
Kol tov. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Avner Cohen, author of two books on the Israeli nuclear program, including The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. Our playout this morning comes from the Jews of Yemen, Dror Yikra, Shabbat Zmira, a song for the Sabbath table, is sung by Sephardic music scholar and performer Dr. Judith Cohen. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.